you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 243. Can you believe that? 243 episodes of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today my guest is Michael Quartararo. And Michael is with a company called the Association of Certified E-Discovery Specialists. It's a company owned by Barbary, a name that most of us in the law space recognize. And as the name suggests, we're going to be talking about e-discovery. And once again, it's going to be one of those episodes where I demonstrate how little I know. And so I'm hoping that by, you know, showing my own ignorance and asking the questions that I need to be answered to gain some level of understanding myself, is that it'll be a service to you, the listener, and that you can get as much out of this as I did. So let's learn about e-discovery with Michael Quartararo. Michael Quartararo, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm thrilled.
I'm delighted to have you with us. I should have asked you earlier, do you go by Mike or Michael?
Mike is fine.
All right. So, Mike, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So, started my career in the 90s as a paralegal. And around that time, anybody who's around back then would remember, you know, the Enrons and the WorldComs of the world in the legal space anyway.
that's when issues like Enron were the most dominating political news story of the day.
Yeah.
Unlike exactly. Today, which would be like third or fourth on the list.
Yeah, they wouldn't make the front page at all.
Exactly. But
yeah. And so, I mean, combine that with, you know, what was then, we called also another news story back then, the dot-com era.
Yeah.
And, you know, it made for an interesting mix of technology and law. And so I chose to pivot into more of a legal technology role. I was working at Skadden at the time, big firm on the, big international firm, actually.
Sure.
And frankly, just never looked back, Neil. I went from paralegal to, you know, I mean, we used to call it paratechnical. I became a database specialist and a project manager, and I started running discovery projects related to these massive class actions, security litigations, and things like that. And so I spent about 10 years at Skadden, left there in 2008, and took a role to build a department at another big firm in New York, Strook & Strook & Levin, built their legal, their litigation support and e-discovery practice area, so to speak, and brought all kinds of new technologies in and built a team for them. In the meantime, I got asked to start teaching at a small school in Tempe, Arizona, Bryan University, and start teaching, you know, a lot of what is e-discovery. You know, we haven't uttered that word yet. What is e-discovery? What we know today as e-discovery. Electronic discovery is really just the discovery of electronic documents, as opposed to, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we did all this stuff on paper.
Right.
And so I started teaching electronic discovery and combined it with a little bit of project management. I'd pursued a project management certification along the way. And so I did that. And then from that, I started writing a book in about 2013. I wrote a book called Project Management Electronic Discovery. That book came out in 2016. Shortly thereafter, I left the firm You know, having built the department I promised to build, right. And started my own consulting company. I was consulting to law firms and corporate legal and whoever would listen to me at the time. And then, of course, promoting my book, which has done pretty well in the industry.
And the book's still available, right?
Yeah, still available where you buy your online, online book retailers. Yeah.
We will have a link for it in the show notes, so be sure to look there.
I appreciate that. And then about a year ago, actually, October 1st was 1 year, I was approached by the leadership at Barbary. Barbary, of course, is the world's leading bar prep educational organization.
Oh, I know them well. I'm looking at my Barbary prep book still on my bookshelf, even though I took the bar way back in 2004, but I've kept the books because I think they're a valuable resource.
Yeah. No. So Barbary owns a company called ACEDS, the Association of Certified eDiscovery Specialists. It's a training and certification organization specifically focused on eDiscovery, information governance, and some touches of legal technology in general. So they asked me if I'd be interested in running the association, and that's how I got here, and that's what I'm doing today.
Well, let's start with the most basic question, and you kind of touched upon it. What really is e-discovery? I mean, I think most of us have a general understanding of what that means. However, I think most solo and small firm practitioners tend to view it as an issue for big law, more so than solo and small firm practitioners. So help me to understand, what is the scope of what's meant by the term e-discovery?
So it's really just an offshoot of the notion of discovery in general. And anybody who works in legal or went to law school should have taken a civil procedure class that where they learned about discovery in general. The difference is, and I like to say it this way, today we don't write on legal yellow pads anymore. People don't do a lot of handwriting on paper. All documents, all information is stored in computers. And so, the notion of electronic discovery really just stems from a notion that in the mid to late 90s, as computers, desktop computers started appearing on everyone's desk throughout the business world, put aside the legal world, all the documentary evidence that was being created on computers. So there became a need to retrieve that information. And as you well know, again, anyone in legal would know there's rules for admitting evidence, for authenticating evidence. And if you've got a smoking gun email in someone's computer, you need to go in there and get it out properly, preserve it properly, not alter it or destroy it. And electronic documents are very volatile. You can alter a document fairly easy just by opening it in some instances. So you have to be really careful.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here just for a second. So sure. I've done both personal injury law and family law. Both of those are discovery-based practices. And originally, I got the medical records in personal injury law in hard copy format. And in family law, I got the bank statements in hard copy format. Later, I got the medical records in PDF form. And same with the bank records. But fundamentally, other than the mechanism by which those documents were delivered to me in the discovery process, it wasn't all that different than the hard copy. So is that e-discovery or is that just the tip of the iceberg?
It really is just the tip of the iceberg. Those are pretty flat, static documents. There's not a lot of controversy about a bank statement right. or a medical record. In many ways, that's very much like the paper version from, 40 years ago.
Okay.
Where it gets a little tricky is when you start talking about email, when you start talking about databases, when you start talking about mobile devices, text messaging, what we call these Internet of Things devices. We've got refrigerators that talk and thermostats that you can set from your office and doorbells with cameras. And all of these things, all of these devices are creating massive amounts of data that can sometimes become relevant in a litigation. And so there's a need for specialists to go in and get that. The average person doesn't know how to retrieve one's text messages from their adversary's mobile phone.
Right.
And that's becoming more and more necessary.
You see it all the time, again, in family law, most notably for me personally, is that, you know, opposing counsel comes in with a screenshot of the text message that purports to be either from or to your client. And that's their sole means of providing, their sole way of providing that piece of content. But what you don't know is everything around it. And whether or not that's an isolated message or one that's part of a string that are equally damning or more so. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that we're not always able to retrieve that information in a way that sustains the rules and complies with the rules of discovery.
That's right. And even more so, the rules of evidence. And I'm not saying in the right case, in the right...
The picture might be just enough.
It may suffice. And obviously, you'd probably need to authenticate that by putting someone on the stand to say, yeah, I took that screenshot and that's the real screenshot and I swear it is.
And here's my phone. You can see it.
Right. But when you're talking about, any kind of products litigation, any kind of larger litigation, and small and solos get involved in those just as much, whether it's from the plaintiff or defense side. You know, there's massive amounts of information. You're gonna put a witness on the stand every time you need to authenticate a screenshot. That's not a very efficient way to do things.
Right. So then, given that we recognize that there's more to e-discovery than just electronic delivery of documents, what is the attorney to do? How do they go about educating themselves or maybe taking advantage of a resource such as yours to provide that knowledge base?
So we're set up, obviously, as part of an education company. We're a training and sort of specialty certification organization in e-discovery. And what we're trying to do is increase sort of technology competence. It's becoming more and more a requirement. 28 or 30, I think, state bars have now said technology is something that lawyers need to know. It's part of their ethical responsibility. And so we're really just positioning ourselves to help advance technology in the legal sector. What attorneys need to do is honestly... And I've struggled with this my entire career because I've worked at firms where, you know, there's always resistance to technology. Yeah. They say you're changing things. You're taking time away from lawyers doing good lawyerly work and the billable hour. And, you know, there's entire conversations and debates that happen in that space. But what we're trying to do ultimately is make the process more efficient. We're trying to help lawyers tell the story, because at the end of the day, that's what this is all about. They're trying to create a narrative that suits their claims and or defenses, right? And you do that with facts. You do that with information. And all of that information is inside a computer or on a server or in the cloud. And so you've got to get that information out. And lawyers who are not doing that, yeah, there are cases, Neil, where that's just not necessary.
Yep.
But the vast majority of I don't know a case that doesn't somehow involve an electronic document in some way, shape, or form today.
No, well, I would totally agree with that. So here's the dilemma that I'm at. If I'm the solo or small firm practitioner, I've got a case, I've got to get this data. You know, I can generate the discovery request that ostensibly produces the data, but if it's delivered to me in a way that I don't know how to process it or extract the information from it, what are my next steps?
So it's a great question. And I like to answer that question because I get it frequently enough. The end of the day, if you don't know how to do it, you need to get somebody who does.
Okay.
And there are obviously an entire service and software provider industry that's valued at $15 billion today has grown out of this need to get electronic documents and information from various systems. So if you don't know how to do it, you need to get someone who does. And that means either calling on a service provider or another expert who knows how to do that, or getting educated yourself. And that's kind of where ACEDS comes in. ACEDS provides that education, that certification, that validates that you know what you're doing in that space.
All right. So let's say I'm a firm that routinely has this need, and I don't want to outsource it every single time, or maybe I've done so and had mixed results or whatever, and I take it upon myself to find out, what do I need to learn and or teach my staff, or how do I do this training? I find this group, this ACEDS, Association of Certified E-Discovery Specialists. What do I do? Do I take classes from them? Do I buy a book from them? You know, what kind of training is provided, and how do I implement that with myself and or my team?
So there's a few options there. Obviously, we have the training programs, the classes, the courses that lead to gaining the knowledge yourself. And the certification is just kind of the icing on the cake. The certification is a validation, or it verifies or creates a baseline level of knowledge for those who take and pass the certification. But the training is available in and of itself. And frankly, we're not the only training association in this space. There are many other organizations that are doing this training, service providers, software companies. Everybody's training in e-discovery because, I mean, it's beneficial to them. But to your question about what do I need to do as the solo or small practitioner, is either get the training yourself or get your team trained. Now, it doesn't always happen that attorneys want to get into the weeds on the technology. They may want to just have a high level understanding, but then they'll have, many firms have either paralegals or litigation support or some form of legal support personnel who would mostly do a lot of the work in this space, the collecting of documents, the processing of documents, putting them into a review platform. And that's kind of where the attorneys come in, because in most instances, attorneys are reviewing documents, right? So they're making privilege calls. They're making relevance calls. Those are legal determinations that legal support folks are probably not going to make. So the support personnel would typically gather the information from the client, put it into a platform, and then the attorneys can look at it in a uniform way. Because remember, we're collecting documents from a bunch of disparate systems. Right, you might have email, you might have Word documents, you might have database tables, or mobile phone data, and those are all different systems. They don't all play together. The idea is to collect that information in a sound and defensible way, have a chain of custody, process it into a uniform format, and then present it to the attorneys in much the same way that you presented years ago a box of paper.
I'm trying to visualize what that uniform format of all these disparate data sources might take. What would that look like?
So picture it like this. Most of these platforms, we call them e-discovery platforms or document review platforms. There are dozens of them on the market. We won't get into names, but at the end of the day, they kind of all do the same thing. And what they basically do is, when you process data through these platforms, it extracts what is called the metadata. The metadata is the to, the from, the author, the date last modified, and the text of the document.
Sure.
And it puts that into a table akin to what a spreadsheet might look like. A series of cells with columns and rows that contain each of those pieces of information, right? So put that on the side for a moment, a spreadsheet full of a bunch of data, author names, dates, recipients, titles of documents, and then, of course, the text. On the other side of the screen, if you will, picture a photograph of a piece of paper. And there's it's more complicated than that, but I'm trying to present a straightforward way of looking at it. So now you've got a picture of the document, and you can scroll through it just like you might do a PDF or even a Word document, right? And then on the other side, you've got this table of data. And that presented on the screen, no matter what data source that information came from, it's presented in a uniform way so that attorneys can quickly either search or sort, look at the documents, zoom into the document, examine the data and the document, and make a decision about the relevance or the importance of that document to the legal dispute before them.
Today's episode is brought to you by the team at Spotlight Branding. For many years, lawyers like you have spent thousands of dollars on marketing campaigns that generate tons of leads, but often left many of them in the dust once the campaign ended. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. Their Content Loop system not only nurtures all of your leads and contacts in perpetuity, but it's done by pushing out quality, evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing efforts actually work. Spotlight Branding's Content Loop makes it nearly impossible for your network to forget about you, which means they'll think of you first when they or someone they know needs legal help. Spotlight Branding has turned hundreds of lawyers across the country into the go-to attorney in their community with their Content Loop by producing engaging content that speaks to your clients' needs and fears, and they can do the same for you. To get started, they're offering listeners of The Law Entrepreneur a free download that explains the Content Loop and how you can put it into practice in your law firm's marketing strategy. Just go to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, spotlightbranding.com/TLE to get your copy. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher ROI. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. Well, now you got my technical juices flowing because you know I'm a techie from way back. So I'm thinking that I've got this database of content here. Now I can do all kinds of, as you said, searches, queries. I can do relational or conditional or branching inquiries and slice this data and maybe find connections and trends that wouldn't otherwise appear to me if I'm just looking at one entry at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that a fair statement?
No, absolutely. And you know, it goes even further today with things like machine learning and some of the analytic tools that we have. You know, identifying patterns in documents has become so easy once you've got all that data, once you've got all that text, you can do things with it that you could not do with a box of paper many years ago. You just, I mean...
Or would have taken you an extraordinary number of man hours.
Oh, it's just incredible. And now one person sitting at a computer terminal can parse through that data. And it's not like a box of paper holds about 2,500 sheets of paper. That's a good deal of work just to look through that box of paper and read it, right? We're talking about millions and millions of documents all at once that you can go through in seconds with a search, that you can sort, that you can identify some linguistic patterns, you know, using machine learning and analytic tools. It's just so vastly different. And I mean, frankly, it's because the amount of information has grown so tremendously large, but
yeah.
That still the lawyers need to get that information. They need those facts to tell their story.
Well, the scenario that I'm envisioning for most solo and small firm practitioners, particularly those who are outsourcing a lot of work to virtual assistants or remote assistants, is that the attorney gets some training to become conversant in and to develop a level of understanding about how all these platforms work and what they can do with them, and then retains a specialist, as you said, either on a full-time basis or a part-time basis as a paralegal or litigation support specialist who has an intimate understanding of the systems and can actually do all the extraction and presentation work on their behalf. Is that a typical scenario?
That is. That's pretty much. And the only sort of alternative way of doing that is, you know, you might outsource it to a service provider or vendor.
Right. Right. So how long would it take me, you know, to become minimally conversant in this genre? Because, what I know about it, you can put on the head of a pin at the moment. I envision that I'm going to need something like this, or that I'm woefully behind. So what do I do? I want to take some classes. I want to get somebody on my staff certified.
Yeah. So it's really a pretty straightforward process. It doesn't take, I mean, everybody learns at a different pace, obviously. Mm-hmm. Our program is designed with learning objectives. It is vetted by data scientists and psychometricians, so that it's, you know, with the Barbary infrastructure behind us, we have the advantage of having instructional design professionals behind the scenes helping us fine tune. You know, the
you're not reinventing the educational wheel,
exactly. Yeah. And the ACEDS exam, the Certified eDiscovery Specialist Certification, is not unlike any other standardized examination. It's 145 questions, 4 hours to take the exam. They're all scenario-based, similar to like bar exam questions, multiple choice. And again, it validates your knowledge of the eDiscovery processes. And of course, we provide the education that leads to that. Mm-hmm. So we've got a study guide, we've got a live class, we've got recorded sessions, we have a mentorship program, and we do study groups to help prepare people for the exam. We generally give people a year from the time they enroll to complete the programs. Some of them are self-paced, some of them are on a schedule, like the live mm-hmm. class, obviously we schedule.
Sure.
And as a general rule, I mean, I like to say this, like, look, if you're a lawyer or a paralegal or working in legal support somewhere, you probably have a lot of the foundational stuff already. You understand what discovery is. So that's like half the battle, right? The only difference between discovery 50 years ago and discovery today is the places where we're discovering the information, right? That the process of discovery, the federal rules of civil procedure haven't changed. Well, they have, but they're still requests for documents.
And right, but they've changed to also recognize the importance of e-discovery.
Exactly. It was in 2006 that they inserted the words electronically stored information into Federal Rule 26. And that's really, if you really want to say it, that's when e-discovery was born in the federal judiciary, at least.
Sure. Sure. So then help me connect that final dot here. So I've got, you know, either somebody doing it for me, a service provider, or I've got a paralegal on my staff that I've taken the time to put through the program so that they're a certified e-discovery specialist. How then does the data thus acquired get presented before the court? Is there something in this process that is unique to e-discovery? I mean, I know we have issues of chain of evidence and that kind of thing, and certification that business record kept in the ordinary course of business. But is there something about the whole process that I need to know about translating this understanding into something that I can put before the court?
It's really a question of volume and relevance.
Okay.
And so when we get involved in litigation, we might collect 1 million documents, right, from a client. And that's not unheard of today, honestly. Even in small cases, there could be 1 million documents.
Yeah, and I know my original level of thinking was, what do you mean, a million documents that are PDF documents or Word documents? But we're talking about, you know, each text message, each email message, and the like counts, right?
Precisely.
And all so the different. It's probably not hard to get to 1 million.
No, it's not. It grows. I mean, I don't have any, you know, sort of average numbers to give you, but I haven't seen a case that had less than 100,000 documents in many, many years. But the point I was driving toward was, you might collect all that information because you believe it's potentially relevant, but the process that gets you into the courtroom for trial, and understanding there's very few trials these days, but okay, at the end of the day, you might use 10 or 50 or 100 of those documents in a really big, long trial in the courtroom as actual exhibits that mm-hmm. you put in front of the jury or the trier of fact, the judge. So it's this process of really honing in on what is truly relevant. What documents actually tell your story to the trier of fact? And it varies dramatically. Nowadays, courtrooms are equipped with monitors and computer equipment and projectors. And so lawyers used to go into court with, you know, yellow legal pads and boxes of paper and easels with these blown up foam boards.
Now it's an iPad and a strong connection to the TV.
Exactly. Yeah. And so those documents,
the whole concept
that were, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The whole concept then is, once I've determined what's relevant, is no different than trial prep in any other perspective.
Precisely. That part of it hasn't changed. It's just a question of how do you present the document, right? And so you do it on a screen as opposed to on a foam board.
So in prepping for this discussion today, you know, I looked up a few things because admittedly, I'm woefully ignorant in this area. And I came across something called the legal hold process.
Yes.
I have no idea what that is.
So, a legal hold...
Allow me to demonstrate just how stupid I am.
you know, it's funny because, you know, we kind of started with... I referenced what is e-discovery, right? And so, it's so awkward when you get asked that question. What do you do, right? Not so much for me anymore, but when I was back at the firm, so people would ask, what do you do? I said, well, I work in e-discovery. And they're like, huh? It's an awkward question. So it's not unusual to hear what's a legal hold, also sometimes known as a litigation hold. It's really part of the obligation every party to litigation, to regulatory investigations, any legal matter, frankly, has an obligation to preserve evidence. And that's really a common law obligation. Sure. Anybody who's been to law school knows that. The legal hold is a process, and it's funny because it's not in the rules anywhere. It's a common law notion that really just comes from an old British case, and I can't remember the name of it. Nah, it'll come to me. In any event, the idea is that if you're sued, you can't go shredding all your documents, right? You can't go deleting everything and hiding the potential evidence. You have to preserve it. And so a legal hold is really just the duty to preserve. An illegal hold is a notification that goes out to the relevant people. We call them custodians because they are sort of the keepers of their documents. Whatever's on your computer, on your phone, or if you're the IT director at an organization, what's on your servers? And the duty there is to preserve that information. So we put out what is called the legal hold. It is a notification to those people who may have relevant information to not delete anything, to begin thinking about how you're going to collect them, to take certain steps to preserve that information. And it can be fairly complicated in big organizations. For an attorney, there's a certain obligation there along with the client to ensure that nothing sort of slips through the cracks, that you don't lose any relevant data. And the legal hold is just a notification to people to hold on to their data because you've been sued.
Yeah, I mean, you can understand, as now that you've mentioned it, it's painfully obvious how important this would be in terms of electronic information. You don't want somebody to say, oh, we've been sued. We better erase that email account.
Right. And that, so that happens more often. The legal hold process is probably the most sort of tangentially litigated issue.
Yeah.
When did you put the hold in place? How do we know something didn't get deleted? How do we know? Because some computer systems just delete information as a matter of course. It's not even a person. If it becomes old or stale, sure, They'll move it off because it needs space to store other things.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? And the legal hold is designed to stop that process, to preserve that information. It ties into what we call retention and the notion of information governance. How are organizations maintaining or storing their information, backing it up and retaining it?
Yeah, and I see how that would be critically important. Are there some things about that process that we should be aware of, some important aspects of that?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing you want to know is what has triggered the process. And the case law talks about it in the context of if you anticipate or have actual notice of a legal action, that triggers the process. Now you need to start thinking about, okay, what do I need to preserve, right? And then from that, have a conversation with your client. You want to have a conversation with the other parties. Okay, what are we preserving in this case? Who has potentially relevant information? And then you might have a conversation with those individuals and let everybody know. Ultimately, the legal hold process requires that you reduce the notice to the individuals to writing. Send it around, whether it's an email or a memo or some formal document. There's actually software out there that does this process for you and tracks the responses and everything, makes people acknowledge it. But you want to be clear. A notice might say, the company has been sued. We need to preserve information related to and set out a series of facts or, identify the legal dispute. And then clearly direct people, do not delete anything, hold on to anything that may potentially be relevant, and give them clear instructions on how to do that. If you don't have someone to do that, get someone to do that for you. It is, again, the one area where we see the most activity.
Sure.
In terms of like sanctions motions and motions to compel, raising questions about did you preserve the information?
Yeah. No, I can see that absolutely. So is there a particular practice area that lends itself more readily to these challenges?
It used to be, I feel, when I started doing this, that it almost entirely was focused on litigation. So when I would talk to transactional lawyers or, restructuring lawyers or real estate lawyers,
would be like,
yeah, they were like, that stuff doesn't apply to me. And I was like, yeah, it does, guys. Electronic documents are electronic documents, and a real estate transaction can turn into a litigation pretty quickly if the buyer or the seller becomes unhappy. And so today, Neil, it's not just litigation. It's everywhere. Think about intellectual property, right? All that stuff is done on computers. Big pharma there's massive databases and scientific notes. The code that's written for software, all of that becomes discoverable if anything turns into litigation. So I guess I would say it is a uniquely litigation-oriented process.
Yeah.
But it spills over into other things, antitrust, bankruptcy. I can think now,
you know, just going thinking out loud, that while the initial practice area may not itself be an aspect that one has to consider e-discovery in, I think, for instance, I do estate planning. Don't necessarily have to have that in order to write a valid estate plan. However, should that estate plan be challenged in court and then go to litigation, right? I can see where you want to have all those emails. Who was influencing?
Looking at all the earlier drafts.
That's right, earlier drafts. And who had all the emails influencing grandma and what text messages were sent back and forth.
Exactly.
So it really then does become an e-discovery issue.
That is exactly right. And the example I was going to use as well, estate planning, anything related to wills and estates, all that stuff is written down. Where are they writing that stuff? On a computer.
On a computer, yeah. Great. Well, listen, Michael, this has been fascinating. To say that I've been educated is an understatement. Every time I touch this subject, I find myself, you know, learning more and more and recognizing that how little I really did know, that I need to spend some time increasing my own level of competence here. If anybody in the audience comes to that same realization that they need to get smarter on this subject area, how can they go about reaching you and what do you suggest?
So I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn. You can obviously look me up there personally. I would encourage everybody to go to the website, aceds.org. And look at the offerings there. I will at some point make arrangements for your listeners to have a discount code.
Oh, that's nice of you.
Yeah, no, happy to do it. And we'll put that out with the episode when the time comes.
Great. So we'll have both your LinkedIn and the URL for ACED's organization in the show notes. And yeah, if you've got a discount that you'd like to extend to our listeners, if they want to take advantage of anything that they've heard here today, we'll include that in the notes as well. And Michael, I couldn't thank you more for taking the time to be with us today.
It was my pleasure, Neil. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Thanks again for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.